The House comes to questions for oral answer. Question number one is in the name
Mr. Speaker.
The Sorry, a point of order.
A point of order.
The Honourable Phil Twyford.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I'd like to correct an answer from yesterday in response to questions from Chris Bishop. I said that my officials have not recommended a process for Auckland Light Rail that would have allowed all market...
Order. Is it? I presume the member is seeking leave.
Oh, I beg your pardon. I'm seeking leave to make a correction.
Is there any objection to that? There appears to be none. And can I just recommend to members that they don't do it at lunchtime? Mr. Twyford.
Mr. Speaker, I'd like to correct an answer from yesterday in response to questions from Chris Bishop. I said that my officials have not recommended a process for Auckland Light Rail that would have allowed all market participants the opportunity to bid for the delivery of the project. One of the options presented to Cabinet would have allowed that, but it's not in the public interest to release any further details until the commercial process has concluded.
Question number one is in the name of the Honourable Nikki Kaye.
Mr. Speaker, question to the Prime Minister. Does she agree with the Right Honourable Winston Peters that New Zealand has been in lockdown for far too long and needs to be at level one now with a trans-Tasman bubble already operating, as reported by the New Zealand Herald? And if so, what steps will she take to advance that?
The Right Honourable Winston Peters.
On behalf of the Prime Minister, I'd first... Your pardon? Well, it always has been. It's not going to change. In fact, we're only going to get better and better, unlike certain people in this House. Now, back to answering on behalf of the Prime Minister. I first would like to congratulate the member for her elevation to the Deputy Leadership of the National Party. Now, I do agree with the Deputy Prime Minister. As I said on Tuesday, quotes, there were different opinions, particularly expressed by the likes of members of New Zealand First, around the pace of moving into level one, end of quotes. The Coalition has always been in lockstep on the direction of travel ever since COVID-19 hit our shores. But it's fair to say that the Deputy Prime Minister is very keen to see us move to alert level one and establish a trans-Tasman bubble as of yesterday. The Deputy Prime Minister's comments reflect the views of many people on both sides of the Tasman and our ability to have serious debates and differ, but have a consensus at the end of it.
Supplementary. Does she agree with the Deputy Prime Minister that the country should be in level one right now?
On behalf of the Prime Minister, I think I made it very clear to Jane Patterson of RNZ on Tuesday and other journalists who cared to have regard to what I've said. She said, when she set the parameters out there, at the latest, and gave that date, which means it could be before that date. And then she said also there's going to be a review 2 weeks after the announcement. That means that the Prime Minister and others envisage the possibility of it being sooner rather than later. No, nonsense is your specialty. I'm dealing with facts and words because words matter.
Supplementary question. Does she agree with the Deputy Prime Minister that the country should be in level one right now?
On behalf of the Prime Minister, I think she made it very, very clear. She doesn't agree with the Deputy Prime Minister. But it coming as soon as possible is the Prime Minister's aspiration, as it is for the rest of the Cabinet and the Coalition. That's why she put these two dates out there, which suggest first the review and the outside date being the latest, which suggests it could be much sooner, if the evidence suggests it should be so.
Supplementary, has she had a detailed discussion with the Deputy Prime Minister about his view of the lockdown going on far too long?
On behalf of the Prime Minister, it should come as no surprise that we've had very comprehensive discussions, not just with the Deputy Prime Minister, but with every member of Cabinet, because we all have views to suggest and put forward. We all have people around the country who have alternative views, and discussion and proper debate is what this coalition government is becoming famous for.
Supplementary. Does she have any concerns about the confidentiality of Cabinet when her Deputy Prime Minister is revealing Cabinet discussions in public?
On behalf of the Prime Minister, now there's the rub, isn't it? Because if that was true, then I, as the Prime Minister, will be responsible for the same thing that was alleged by someone who knows nothing about the constitutional nature of this country, will never be in the Cabinet, doesn't know what the manual's all about. To think that that member's repeating it astonishes me, because the Prime Minister, answering the question, first disclosed this information herself to Jane Paterson of RNZ on Tuesday, 24 hours before the Deputy Prime Minister said anything.
Question, Mr. Speaker.
The Honourable Grant Robertson.
Mr. Speaker, has the Prime Minister seen any reports around issues to do with the confidentiality of discussions in this building this week?
On behalf of the Prime Minister, indeed I have. And to be true, even though it's not in the bailiwick of the coalition which I seek to lead, it deeply shocked me that politicians could behave that way, where they would use inside information to destroy internally the very party they belong to, and where those that have been so heinously treated by demotion have decided to fight from the back benches against those who are unwantonly and wrongly and probably in vain promoted.
Supplementary. Has the Foreign Minister advocated to her or to the Cabinet to proceed faster around the Trans-Tasman bubble?
On behalf of the Prime Minister, take a wild guess.
Supplementary. Has the Foreign Minister advocated a date by which time he would like to see the Trans-Tasman bubble established?
On behalf of the Prime Minister, in one word, yesterday.
Supplementary. What are the issues that are holding up the delivery of a Trans-Tasman bubble?
On behalf of the Prime Minister, the reality is, and everyone has got their reasons for having their view, but it is the concern to ensure that the stellar record of defeating COVID-19 has perhaps a few more days of an unblemished record before people would be more comfortable with change. And that is a fair sentiment. Whether we all agree with it is a different matter.
Supplementary. Does she agree with economist Brad Olson that 80% of the total job losses in New Zealand would come from small businesses, most of which will never be widely reported? And does she think that staying in level two longer will make the situation far worse?
Order. I'm going to ask the Deputy Leader of the National Party to relate that question to the primary question.
Supplementary. Does she believe that staying in level two longer will lead to significant job losses in New Zealand?
On behalf of the Prime Minister, of course she agrees. I agree with that, because that's what anyone who knows the remote elements of the economy are about would know that. The reality is the longer we go in, the more difficult it is for us to recover. But that said, there are medical caveats and conditions and provisos which the decision makers seek to ensure is first and foremost in their minds. But it's nothing new. We don't need a group of economists to tell us what this means. What we need, of course, is the right ideology, or the lack of blind ideology, to take us as fast as possible out of it. And the member from Epsom can keep on laughing, because that's all he's going to do.
Supplementary. What reports has she seen on the number of businesses that are likely to close as the government waits weeks to move to level one?
On behalf of the Prime Minister, to be honest, there have been all sorts of comments and statements and predictions, but in terms of analytical reports, I believe none.
The Honourable Chris Hipkins. Will she and the Cabinet be weighing the risk to businesses of a further outbreak of COVID-19 when they make decisions about the further relaxation of current restrictions?
On behalf of the Prime Minister, I think you can take that as read.
Question number two, Jamie Lee Ross.
Mr. Speaker, my question is to the Minister of Health, the NAS. Is the development of a safe and effective vaccine for COVID-19 and the use of that vaccine a crucial tool that will contribute, or is likely to contribute, to preventing the risk of the outbreak or spread of COVID-19?
The Honourable Dr. David Clark.
Mr. Speaker, yes, and that's why I was pleased on Tuesday to join the Minister of Research, Science and Innovation and the Foreign Minister to announce the government's COVID-19 vaccine strategy and the investment of $37 million to support the development of a vaccine.
Entry. Does Section 11 of the COVID-19 Public Health Response Act 2020 give him as Minister of Health the authority to make orders that, quote, require persons to take any specified actions or comply with any specified measures that contribute or are likely to contribute to preventing the risk of the outbreak or spread of COVID-19?
Mr. Speaker, this government and indeed previous governments have never compelled any individual to get vaccinated against their wishes. That is not about to change. We will not force people to get immunised against their will. That said, we know vaccination works, and when there is a COVID-19 vaccine, we will do all we can to ensure New Zealanders get immunised. I would note that there are eight measures listed in the Act that people could be required to undertake to reduce the risk of COVID-19, including staying in a specified place, staying physically distant from people, and reporting for medical examination or testing. Vaccination is not one of the measures listed.
Supplementary. Has he seen any reports of other coercive public policy measures being proposed relating to vaccinations which would see a parent losing their benefit or working for families entitlement if they did not vaccinate their children, commonly referred to as a no jab, no pay policy?
Mr. Speaker, I have seen that advocated. I don't agree with Mr. Luxon on that point. And I would note also that there is provision to refuse medical treatment under the Bill of Rights Act.
Question number three, Maya Lubick.
Mr. Speaker.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker.
My question is to the Minister of Education and asks, what action is the government taking to invest in training and education for people who have lost their jobs or who want to move into a different sector where prospects are better?
The Honourable Chris Hopkins.
Mr. Speaker, as we emerge from this health crisis, Budget 2020 has made major investments in jobs and training as we get New Zealand working again. Our trades and apprenticeships training package will provide opportunities for New Zealanders of all ages to receive trades and vocational training. It sits alongside expanding the Ministry of Social Development's employment services and further rolling out the successful He Potama Rangatahi program to tackle youth unemployment, and we'll be continuing to add to it as part of our work to rebuild the economy.
Supplementary. What will the trades and apprenticeships training package do to provide affordable training options for people who have been affected by the economic impacts of COVID-19?
Mr. Speaker, firstly, we'll be providing funding for tens of thousands of additional places in tertiary education over the next couple of years to meet increased demand from learners who are expected to experience the effects of the economic downturn. Secondly, we'll be making targeted vocational training programs free for all ages, not just for school leavers, over the next 2 years. And this will help some of the people who have lost their jobs to retrain and also allow new employees in some of the essential services to train on the job. The Targeted Training and Apprenticeships Fund will include programs that are linked to industry skill needs, for example, in building and construction, agriculture, manufacturing, and also in other vocational courses like community health counselling and care work. And the funding will be available from the 1st of July this year.
Supplementary. How will the trades and apprenticeships training package help to keep apprentices earning and learning?
Mr. Speaker, we'll be providing some financial support for employers to retain and keep training their apprentices. We're also going to be putting additional funding into group training schemes so that they can continue to employ apprentices whose host employers, who are primarily small construction businesses, are unable to support them and provide on-the-job opportunities. These initiatives will be critical for continuity because the last thing we want to see is apprentices and trainees having been let go when we are really going to need them in the future.
What else will the government be doing through the Trades and Apprenticeships Training Package?
Mr. Speaker, heaps, but I'll give a couple of quick examples. We're building on the volume of Trades Academy places in secondary schools over the next couple of years to provide further opportunities for young New Zealanders. We're funding the establishment of industry-led workforce development councils so that industry can strategically plan for the skill needs of their industries as they recover from COVID-19. And we're establishing and putting further work into our online careers system so that learners and workers throughout their lifetime can plan and manage their careers. This will help all New Zealanders understand their transferable skills, and it will be particularly valuable for those who can't easily show a clear work history.
No, the members had two supplementary
questions. A point of order.
Oh, sorry, a point of order, Jamie Lee Ross.
I apologise, I should have done this at the end of question two. I seek leave to table and introduce a member's bill in my name, the COVID-19 Public Health Response, brackets, Safeguard from Forced Vaccinations, end brackets, amendment bill.
Is there any objection to that course of action we take? There is. Question number four, the Honourable Paul Goldsmith.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. My question is to the Minister of Finance. What priority does he give to further opening up the economy to save jobs?
Speaker.
The Honourable Grant Robertson.
My highest priority is the saving and creation of jobs. This includes by safely opening up the economy in a way that doesn't put the health gains won by all New Zealanders at risk if there were to be another outbreak of COVID-19 that would force us to move back up alert levels.
Does he agree with Deputy Prime Minister Winston Peters that we need to come out of level two now to further open up the economy?
Mr. Speaker, I have great respect for the Deputy Prime Minister, the Right Honourable Winston Peters, but on this matter we disagree.
Does he prefer the Prime Minister's view that she explained yesterday, that she takes her advice from Ashley Bloomfield about how to come out of level two and to open up the economy?
Mr. Speaker, in my experience, it is always good to prefer the view of the Prime Minister or indeed the leader of the party the member might happen to be in, whoever that might be.
Does he agree with the proposition that while we trust Ashley Bloomfield to look after our health, we don't necessarily want him running our economy?
Speaker, the government has said from day one that the very best recipe for the recovery of the New Zealand economy has been a strong public health response. That has been borne out by what has happened in New Zealand. We look broadly at all of the things that New Zealanders would want us to when we make consideration about moving through alert levels, and I believe we've taken a responsible path.
How many extra jobs will be lost each week we remain in level two, as opposed to being in level one?
The member will be aware that a number of different calculations have been made by both the Reserve Bank and the Treasury. The Reserve Bank have estimated that when we were in level three, GDP was going to be reduced by about 19%. Then when we went to level two, it would be by about 8.8%. And then under level one, 3.8%. So quite clearly, the difference between level three and level two, very significant in terms of GDP and indeed jobs. The difference between level two and level one, less of a gap between those two levels. But I don't obviously have those specific numbers here.
Well, isn't it at a time when we're losing more than 1,000 jobs a day, isn't it essential for him to at least make an attempt to quantify the difference between job losses at level two and level one?
Member's question is completely incorrect.
Not quite sure how it is. Does he acknowledge the concerns of restructuring specialist Grant Graham about waiting further weeks to reopen the economy, quote, knowing that the cost will not only be extreme but unjustifiable?
Speaker, again, obviously I don't agree with the premise of that question. We have taken a responsible and measured path to lead New Zealand through a 1-in-100-year crisis. The idea that we would yo-yo back up levels would have a huge impact on the New Zealand economy. We are making good progress, much better progress than many other countries around the world, and we will continue to take all of the expert advice into account and make decisions in the best interests of New Zealanders.
Question number five, the Honourable Judith Collins.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. To the Minister for Economic Development. Does he stand by his statement of 1 April 2020 that he was developing a pipeline of infrastructure projects that, quote, would begin as soon as we are able to move around freely and go back to work, end quote? If so, how many new projects have now started?
The Honourable Phil Twyford.
I stand by my actual statement that we, as in the government, are developing a pipeline of infrastructure. Some of this pipeline includes the government state housing construction program, the additional $1 billion for rail announced in the budget by the Minister of State-Owned Enterprises, schools up and down the country with school improvement projects underway. A number of ministers, including the Minister of Transport, are continuing work on the projects announced in the NZ Upgrade program. The Minister of Finance signalled on Budget Day that more projects will be considered through the COVID Rebuild and Recovery Fund based on the work of the Industry Reference Group. The Minister of Finance is responsible for the COVID Rebuild and Recovery Fund. Ministerial responsibility for the start of projects lies with the relevant portfolio minister. And by way of example, I'm advised by the Minister of Transport that construction has resumed on the Northern Corridor improvements in Auckland, Bayfair to Bay Park and the Bay of Plenty, Mackays to Peka Peka and Peka Peka to Ōtaki, and the Christchurch Northern Corridor. I also note that the Minister of Housing announced on the 9th of May that 240 Kāinga Ora public housing work sites had builders back at work.
Point of order.
A point of order, the Honourable Judith Collins.
Mr. Speaker, the Minister's referred to what he calls his actual statement. I have his statement here. It doesn't seem to be the same as what he said it is, so I wonder if I could seek leave to table the statement that he put out.
Well, we'll just take it simply. The member seeking leave to table a document which is already printed. Normally we wouldn't do that. But seeing the source of the document, I presume it's the press statement, is it, Ms Collins? Is it the press statement?
It's a press statement, and the Minister's he says he's quoted from it today. That's significantly different from it says in the press statement.
Right, okay, well we're not going to make any judgment about difference. But the member has sought to table a document and unusually, I'm going to put it to the House because there appears to be an issue here. Is there any objection to that? There appears to be none. Further supplementary question.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Thank you for that. Is anything holding up his announcement of the, quote, pipeline of infrastructure projects, end quote, that on 1 April he claimed would start as soon as the construction industry returned to work?
Well, I suggest to the member that if she's after the start dates or any reasons for projects starting or not at a particular time, that she should direct her questions to the minister who has responsibility for those projects, such as the Minister for Education, the Minister for Infrastructure, the Minister for Transport, Minister for Housing.
If the minister, if he is now saying he doesn't have responsibilities for these projects, then why did he announce that he was going to have an announcement?
The press statement that the member is referring to was put out by the Minister of Infrastructure, the Honourable Shane Jones, and I, because we were asked by the Minister of Finance to commission some work by the Industry Reference Group chaired by Mark Binns. That's what the press release announced. And I'm pleased to say that work has been completed by the Industry Reference Group.
Why did he say on 1 April that these projects would start as soon as the construction industry returned to work, yet 2 months later he's now telling the House that it wasn't his responsibility?
I entirely reject the premise of the member's question. I've already cited to her a long list of infrastructure projects that are part of the government's infrastructure pipeline that are up and running since the country emerged from level 4 and level 3 lockdown.
How many of the projects that he said would start as soon as the construction industry returned to work will need fast-track consenting in order to proceed?
I suggest the member directs that question to the minister responsible for the RMA fast-tracking legislation, or, alternatively, the various ministers responsible for those projects.
And as the Minister for Economic Development, has he received any advice from the Minister for the Environment on any potential delays to the pipeline of infrastructure projects, and what is that advice?
I've received quite a lot of advice from, as many of my colleagues have, from the Environment Minister about the timing of a number of infrastructure projects generally that will be considered as part of the COVID response and recovery program, and the desire to speed up the RMA consenting process for those projects is the policy intent behind the Honourable David Parker's bill.
Question number six, the Honourable Ron Mark.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. My question is to the Prime Minister and asks, does she stand by her government's investment in New Zealand's infrastructure and capabilities?
On behalf of the Prime Minister, yes, particularly support for our inter-island ferry service. On 14 May 2020, we were pleased to announce that inter-islander ferries are to have their capabilities dramatically improved. Our Cook Strait ferry serve as a critical link between the North and South Islands, both for passengers and cargo, and the $400 million we have set aside for replacing the three ageing inter-island ferries will restore KiwiRail to its rightful place in New Zealand's transport infrastructure.
Speaker. To the Prime Minister, how will the upgraded inter-islander service improve New Zealand's rail network?
On behalf of the Prime Minister, the ships that we will build will be the first brand new purpose-built ferries that New Zealand has had in over 25 years. At the moment, only the Aotearoa is rail-enabled. This is a result of successive governments' failures to invest in New Zealand railways, and as a result, the Aotearoa has a number of expensive technical problems. With the new ships, we will ensure the main trunk line between the North and the South Island is as well-connected and reliable as it should be, whilst ensuring that passenger services take full advantage of the journeys on offer.
Mr. Prime Minister, can you tell the House what investments the government has made in the New Zealand Defence Force's infrastructure and capabilities?
On behalf of the Prime Minister, the Coalition Government has made huge investments in NZDF's infrastructure capabilities and personnel, with $4.3 billion in operating and capital funding allocated in total across the past three budgets. This represents the greatest injection of defence funding in decades. And we're exceptionally proud of our Defence Force and its people, which was a great example being their assistance yesterday in the rescue of two trampers gone for 19 days in Kaurangi National Park. A crew of Royal New Zealand Air Force personnel and an NH90 helicopter successfully searched for Jessica O'Connor and Dion Reynolds, who are now safe and well in the most difficult circumstances. It was a remarkable tale of endurance and survival, but it wouldn't have been possible were it not for our Defence Force again, and as a result of the Coalition Government backing them again.
The Prime Minister, why were the Defence Force called in to assist with that search mission?
I beg your pardon? Here comes Valium again. On behalf of the Prime Minister, the New Zealand Police, for whom we would like also to express our profound admiration and gratitude, requested support of RNZAF NH90 helicopters because of their exceptional capacity and ability and suitability to the type of terrain that the pair found themselves in. Equipped with night vision goggles and winching capabilities, these helicopters and crew performed exceptionally well. And again, it underscores for those who are always critical of the military just how profound their humanitarian reach is. And I want to thank the member in particular as the Minister for Defence, because his opponents have not asked the question of him or me on this issue since the 18th of September 2018.
Order, 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 order. Okay. Question number 7, the Honourable Louise Upston.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. My question is to the Minister for Social Development and asks, what is the total amount spent on her Keep New Zealand Working package announced on the 28th of April?
The Honourable Carmel Cipollone.
Tala Falava, Mr. Speaker. The Keep New Zealand Working package announced a number of initiatives, including a Key New Zealand Working online recruitment platform, 35 new employment centres across the country, a Keep New Zealand Working fast-tracking service for those benefit applicants who need to re-engage quickly with the job market and support for those not on benefit, quick upskilling solutions, for example, the new free online community health course with New Zealand Qualifications Authority unit standards. All costs associated with this have been met using the Ministry's operational budget. The cost of developing the Work and Income online recruitment tool was $244,000. The Ministry has also entered into a partnership with the health sector training provider, MySkill, to deliver free online training modules for people who want to upskill or retrain. The Ministry has committed $160,000 to support this online training initiative.
Does she think she should have committed more than $400,000 to Keep New Zealand Working in light of the thousands of job losses seen in New Zealand since that announcement?
Mr. Speaker, we have made significant announcements in the House with respect to support for employment and upskilling and training. We announced as part of the budget an additional $150 million to go towards MSD employment services, as well as an additional $250 million that will support MSD with recruiting the frontline staff that we will need at this time with respect to not only work-focused case managers and work-focused staff, but also general case managers to support with the demand that we are expecting because of this unprecedented event.
Does she think unemployed New Zealanders were misled when she announced 35 new employment centres as part of her Keep New Zealand Working package that, according to written question 6603, were actually current MSD staff working out of current MSD offices?
Mr. Speaker, due to the restrictions with regards to COVID-19 at level 4 and even level 3, we haven't been able to operate the face-to-face service that we would usually operate. Much of what we have had to do was online and over the phone. So the smart thing for us to do was to consolidate all of the employment-focused staff that we have into centres across the country to make sure that they were focused, working collaboratively, Mr. Speaker. Mr. Speaker, on top of this investment this year with regard to the additional staff that we will be getting to support New Zealanders during this time, I do need to reflect back to last year's budget, where fortunately we were also given funding for 263 additional frontline work-focused case managers that are certainly going to be very useful now. And Mr. Speaker, that was on the back of a decline under the previous government of work-focused case management in MSD offices.
The 35 new employment centres that were part of her announcement, are they new or not?
Mr. Speaker, they were a new way of us working, Mr. Speaker, and we have been very clear about that. It was important that we be innovative and think differently about how we provide support, Mr. Speaker, and that is exactly what we were able to do. Mr. Speaker, more New Zealanders are going to find themselves unemployed because of COVID-19, and so we have moved swiftly as a government to put our resource towards employment, upskilling and training, and to think innovatively about how we work differently to ensure that we're providing support to New Zealanders during these difficult times.
Why did she announce an employment service for those directly impacted by COVID-19 who are not on a main benefit, when her written question answer yesterday says the ministry is still looking into how to do this?
Mr. Speaker, as part of the rapid response program that we undertook before we went into lockdown level 3 and level 4, Mr. Speaker, what we did was we had rapid response teams across the country who were not just working with New Zealanders who were already ready out of employment, but also New Zealanders who were at risk of becoming employed. And so at that point, they were getting in there proactively to provide support to look at their options for alternative employment before they finished in those positions and needed to find work elsewhere.
Question number 8, Chris Bishop.
Point of order, Mr. Speaker.
A point of order, Chris Bishop.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. The Minister at the start of question time corrected an answer to the question yesterday, which was a primary question on notice. And yep. I draw your attention to Standing Orders 184-1 about ministers having an obligation to correct answers at the earliest available opportunity. The House has been sitting all of yesterday evening and indeed this morning, and we've only had the correction at 2 p.m. this afternoon.
Well, that is a fair point of order, and the correction, if the minister was aware of it, should have been made earlier. There are a couple of points. First of all, the point of order should have been taken at the time of the correction, or immediately afterwards. And secondly, I'm not sure that it impacts on the wording of the question that we're about to have. If the member feels that he's been significantly disadvantaged as a result of the correction on the part of the minister, I would propose to seek the leave of the House for this question not to be asked and for an additional question to be given to the National Party on Tuesday, which would, I think, give the member the opportunity to have the question that he would want. Speaker,
you've heard Mr. Bishop's point of order, but he forgot to add the refinement, or the caveat, that is, at the first available opportunity after discovering there was a mistake, he left that part out.
Speaking
to the point of order, is the Deputy Prime Minister implying that the Minister found out his answer yesterday was incorrect at 2 o'clock?
No. Let's leave all of that. I'm now going to order. I'm going to ask Mr. Bishop if he thinks he's been significantly disadvantaged by the correction, and if so, whether he would prefer to ask a question on Tuesday rather than now.
Mr. Speaker, I'll proceed with the question. I'm happy to proceed because I think it's in the public interest we do that.
Okay. Question number 8, Chris Bishop.
To the Minister of Transport. In the Cabinet paper released in June 2019, titled Progressing Our Plans to Deliver Light Rail in Auckland, does one of the redactions include a comment from the Treasury? And if so, what does that comment say?
The Honourable Phil Twyford.
Yes, this comment was redacted in the released Cabinet paper to protect confidentiality of advice and so that negotiations can be carried out without prejudice or disadvantage. And on the basis of that, it's still appropriate to withhold that information.
Order.
Point of order, Mr. Speaker. There are various speakers' rulings, 177-5 and 6, make it clear that the Minister's obligation to the House is separate from their obligations under the Official Information Act.
Yep, and?
And my point is that this is a primary question on notice and we'd like the information.
No, I don't need any help at all. There is no obligation. If the minister says it's not in the public interest to provide that, I listened to him sort of very carefully. He might have used the terms of the Official Information Act, but he made it clear that for commercial sensitivity and to allow the negotiations to proceed, it wasn't appropriate to release the information now. He said he stood by that. Member's absolutely right that, you know, there are different obligations, but if the minister, and I think he in effect
told the House that it's not in the public interest to release the information, then he cannot be forced to. It's a matter for his judgment, no one else.
When he said yesterday the recommended course of action that went to Cabinet from the Ministry of Transport in the paper that I took was the process that we have since undertaken, where does it say in the paper that the twin track process was the recommendation of the Ministry of Transport?
Through me.
When he states in his Cabinet paper at paragraph 65 what his, quote, preferred approach would be in how to deal with the NZ Infra and NZTA proposals, did the paper state other approaches that could be undertaken other than his preferred approach?
Yes.
Why, when the twin track process has concluded and the Ministry of Transport has completed its assessment of both proposals, can he not provide the House with details about alternative proposals and the recommendations from the Ministry?
That's right.
Because the commercial process is still underway.
Did the Treasury support the recommendations in his Cabinet paper?
As I've stated, the comment from Treasury was redacted on the grounds to maintain confidentiality of advice because of the commercial nature of the process.
How can it possibly impact commerciality of advice and the Crown's commercial position as to whether or not the Treasury supported his recommendation to Cabinet?
The content or the substance of the advice is judged to be relevant to the commercial process, and therefore it's appropriate for it not only to be redacted from the release of that Cabinet paper, but to not be in the public interests to release that information now.
What is so explosive about the fact that the Treasury has provided an alternative option to the one that is his preference that would put the Crown at a commercial disadvantage?
There's never been any suggestion that it's explosive.
Question number nine, Joe Lux.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. To the Minister of Revenue, what advice has he received about the uptake of the Small Business Cash Flow Loan Scheme?
The Honourable Stuart Nash.
Tala Falava, Mr. Speaker. The Government has taken decisive and considered action to support small businesses through the COVID-19 pandemic. Today, Inland Revenue advised me that $1 billion in interest-free loans for small businesses has been applied for. Almost 60,000 businesses have applied and 96% have been approved. That's an average amount of around 17,300 per business. 90% of applications are from firms with 10 or fewer staff. A wide cross-section of businesses have applied. The most common are those from the construction industry, accommodation providers, professional firms, and retail. And 88% of those seeking loans also receive support from the wage subsidy grant. Applications are due by the 12th of June, but I'm seeking advice on extending the deadline given the substantial demand for the loans.
How are provincial businesses represented in those who have applied for the Small Business Cash Flow Loan Scheme?
Mr. Speaker, IR has received around 3,062 applications from Tauranga businesses, 2,000 applications from Palmerston North, 1,800 from Whangarei, 1,500 from Nelson and 1,400 from Napier. And more than 25,000 businesses from our largest city, Auckland, have drawn down approximately $425 million. I thank the member Jo Luxon for her advocacy for the businesses of Rangitata and for the insight she shares as a small business owner. The loan scheme has helped 230 businesses in her region to the tune of $4.4 million. I also thank the member Tamati Coffey for his advocacy as a small business owner. More than 1,300 businesses have also accessed this support in his area. My friend Damien O'Connor will also be pleased to hear that government lending has extended 300 businesses in Greymouth, and to the Tourism Minister who is supporting tourism-related businesses, more than 1,800 businesses in his electorate have borrowed $31 million.
What response has he seen from the private sector about the small business cash flow loan scheme?
Mr. Speaker, professional advisers like bookkeepers, accountants and tax agents have backed and endorsed the loan scheme for their clients. For example, Accountants and Tax Agents Institute of New Zealand, which has 400 professional members, have thanked ministers for excellent work in recognising the need of small businesses and for providing an effective package for helping their clients with cash flow at this time. The Small Business Cash Flow Loan Scheme is a targeted and balanced approach to recovery for viable but vulnerable small businesses.
Question number 10, Nicola Willis.
Mr. Speaker, my question is to the Minister of Housing and asks, how many KiwiBuild homes that have been sold off the plans have had their estimated completion date delayed from the date that was communicated to buyers at the time of sale? And will KiwiBuild homes continue to be sold off the plans?
The Honourable Dr. Megan Woods.
Te loa whenua, Mr. Speaker. 72 homes have had a delay of more than 6 months, while an additional 123 have a delay between 1 and 6 months. These houses are all within developments with contracts signed prior to the KiwiBuild reset I announced last December. I do also note that there are 91 homes ahead of schedule. As frustrating as it can be, it's not unusual for construction projects to experience delays. For instance, the New Zealand NZ Law advises people considering purchases off the plans that projects often take years to complete and delays can and do happen. If the member is referring to the Monarch development in Wellington, which constitutes 44 of the 72 properties delayed by 6 months, I can confirm that this is a development arrangement that is no longer used by KiwiBuild. The agreement was signed prior to the KiwiBuild reset announced in September last year, and KiwiBuild houses at this development were marketed and sold before confirmation of a construction contract. When I first heard about this delay in December last year, I had huge sympathy for the first home buyers who had secured these KiwiBuild homes but now face delays. In response, I instructed officials to ensure that no further KiwiBuild houses are to be sold off the plans prior to the developer having funding confirmed. In answer to the second part of the question, yes.
What will she do to help the 44 KiwiBuild buyers in Wellington's delayed Monarch development?
Mr. Speaker, the contracts are not with KiwiBuild. They are with the developer. But as I made publicly clear yesterday, there are a number of purchasers who the developer has released prior to the sunset clause arriving. If those people want to get in touch with my office, I am more than happy to put them in touch with the developer.
Will she do anything to help these first home buyers other than passing on the contact details of the property developer?
Mr. Speaker, as I said, this is an arrangement that is no longer used within KiwiBuild. But what I would like to point out, these are 44 first home buyers that are still looking at the delivery of a first home via KiwiBuild. I will put our record of delivering affordable homes over the opposition when they were in government, who delivered 100 affordable homes through the special housing units in the 9 long years they were in government.
How many KiwiBuild homes have been built?
Mr. Speaker, I'd like to advise the new opposition spokesperson for housing for the National Party that there is a very informative monthly dashboard that is published that tells her all this information, and the latest dashboard will tell her there have been 395 Kiwi homes built.
Will KiwiBuild purchasers in the Monarch development be required to live in their homes for 3 years before selling them?
Mr. Speaker, that will depend on the typology of the home, because of course when we did the reset in September, that was altered for studio and one bedroom apartments, so it will depend on the type of apartment they've purchased.
Will she ensure Kiwi Build buyers in the delayed Monarch development can get their deposits back prior to June 2022.
Mr. Speaker, these are contracts that have been entered into. I am not going to stand in Parliament as a minister and say I'm going to unpick contracts. What I have advised the purchasers to do is to speak to the developer. Some have been released. But, Mr. Speaker, I do note I received communication this morning from someone who is a purchaser in the Monarch development, who understands there is a delay, is still committed to the very good apartment that he is going to have there. So not all people want released from these contracts.
Question number 11, Dr. Shane Ritty.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. To the Minister of Employment, what measures are used to assess the performance and progress of his employment programs?
The Honourable Willie Jackson.
Kia ora, Mr. Speaker.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker.
Such as Mana and Mahi and He Pautama Rangatahi have reporting, monitoring and evaluation processes built into them that measure things like, in the case of Mana and Mahi, employment and training outcomes, and in the case of He Pautama Rangatahi, the number of rangatahi engaged and the proportion of participants that go on to education, employment or training pathways. I receive regular reports updating me on progress and a clear indication these programs work in the decade low unemployment rates we achieved over the past 2 years. However, I want to make it clear to the House that for many people in our vulnerable communities, it's not just about reports or data. It's about opportunities and transforming lives and communities. I mean, we're working with people right at the edge, Mr. Speaker, who've disengaged from secondary school. For example, 30% of those enrolled in He Pautama Rangatahi have no qualification. 37.9% have been expelled or stood down from school. They have barriers to finding and keeping work. Example, 38.9% have no driver's licences. They have disabilities. They've come from long-term generational welfare dependencies. We're talking about kids whose fathers
I am going to interrupt the member. He will have the opportunity for a budget speech at some stage in the future.
Is there a supplementary?
Supplementary. When he said yesterday that the cost-benefit ratio for He Pautama Rangatahi was $2.60, how were the benefits calculated and did they take into account a standard discount rate?
Mr. Speaker, everything that's calculated is worked out through Treasury. We get our numbers back. They do a total assessment of it. It's pretty easy. We've all been around a while. That's how they work things out.
Supplementary.
Shane Ritty.
Thank you.
Shane Ritty, second supplementary.
Thank you. Does he agree that benefits to Māori in his programs need to be a focus, and will he lobby for an increase in the discount rate?
Sorry, I don't quite understand your question.
Does he agree that benefits to Māori in his programs need to be a focus, and will he lobby for an increase in the discount rate?
Mr. Speaker, the majority of people on these programs are Māori, and that member should know that, and he comes from a community that has been hugely disadvantaged, and I will advocate for Māori or groups who've missed out at every opportunity that I'm able to.
Order!
Many questions.
The Right Honourable Winston Peters.
Minister, in his programs, will someone get a fair chance for promotion and not be overlooked regardless of race?
Absolutely, Mr. Speaker. When we talk about race, it's about how these groups have been affected. We help everyone.
Mario Lubeck.
That the Minister answered my question to point two.
Order. Mario Lubeck.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Well, the member's asking about a point of order for a supplementary two back. Well, the member can't do that. Member knows that. He takes it immediately or not at all. Mario Lubeck.
Supplementary.
A point of order,
Speaker,
to McIndoe.
Dr. Shane Ritty was jumping up. You looked immediately at the Right Honourable Winston Peters and allowed him to ask the question. You didn't give Dr. Ritty the chance to raise his point of order.
Well,
I know Dr. Retty is not the loudest member in the chamber, but he did have an open mic. And being on the feet is not good enough. One has to call Mr. McIndoe. And after all these years, you should know that. And the member will not, the member will not argue from his seat.
Are you looking?
Fa'afetai lau afionga ile fofonga fetulai. How does he measure the progress been made in the employment program He Potama Rangatahi?
Kia ora, Mr. Speaker. Our community-led program He Potama Rangatahi works with our rangatahi, Mr. Speaker, who aren't engaged in the employment, education or training. Now, we measure the progress that have been made with this programs around the country in a number of ways. I've received the reports from officials that show 3,472 young people have been engaged through He Potama Rangatahi. 1,625 of them have already been connected to further training or employment. As our program is community-led, they're committed to working with our young people long-term to getting positive outcomes, and we're funding community-driven projects in Tairawhiti, Bay of Plenty, Hawke's Bay, Taitokorau, regions with high numbers of disengaged young people and disadvantaged labour markets. And Mr. Speaker, it's not just about the numbers. We measure progress by these young people, by how their lives have changed, and we've seen real change with these young people.
Supplementary. Is he the responsible minister for the performance and progress of Māori and Pacifica trades training, given he said on Tuesday that it was his only new program that he had taken to Cabinet during lockdown level 4?
Mr. Speaker, yes, I am responsible for Māori trade training and Pacifica trade training, and that member should know we don't need a lot of new programs. We need to support workers. We've done that. 1.6 million workers have been supported. I've supported our Minister of Finance along the way with that. Wage subsidies have benefited New Zealand hugely. We've already got the programs in place. We've already got record. We had record unemployment. We had record Māori unemployment. We've had record Pacifica unemployment. We've got the underutilisation rates up. We've got the disability sector up. We don't need anything fancy and new. We already had something entrenched, and then something like COVID-19 came along.
Supplementary. How has the mana and mahi success rate gone from 84% at the Epidemic Response Committee a few weeks ago to 81% yesterday, or were both figures a guess?
Mr. Speaker, I think I've been very clear. I'm not sure where the member got 84%, but 81%... We've got an 81% success rate in terms of mana and mahi. This is such an exciting and successful program. That member should feel very proud of it. At the moment, he's embarrassing his relations in Whangarei. He should be standing up for mana and mahi rather than his useless no-achievement leader at this stage, Mr. Speaker.
Maia Lubick.
Fa'afetai. What measures does the Minister of Employment look for in the progress of mana e mahi?
Thank you for that. Every month I receive traditional reports from our officials on the progress of mana e mahi, which is of great interest to the opposition, who have no respect for a program that is changing the lives of New Zealanders. They show so far 729 people have started the mana and mahi program. 54% of these are Māori or Pacifica. 35% of them have been on benefit for more than 1 year, and 10% for more than 4 years. 81% of people who start mana and mahi do not return to a benefit. There are a wide range of industries that mana and mahi supports, from agriculture, construction, retail, forestry to manufacturing.
Okay, that's enough.
Shame, Reddy.
Is he denying that he told the Epidemic Response Committee the mana and mahi success rate was 84%?
Mr. Speaker, 84, 81. It should have been 81. I mean, if that's what you're hanging your hat on, why don't you stand up for your people in Whangarei and stand up for the Māori members of National? You're a disgrace, Shane.
Order, order, order. That final comment. Well, quite a lot of it was possibly out of order, but the final comment certainly was the member will stand, withdraw and apologise.
Withdraw and apologise, Mr. Speaker.
Right. Question number 12, Paul Eagle.
Whawhitai, loa whiunga, I le whawhunga, whetu lai. My question is to the Minister for Building and Construction. What recent announcements has she made about supporting our building and construction businesses?
The Honourable Jenny Salesa.
Maloso fua manuele aso, Mr Speaker. This government is ensuring that construction subcontractors will have the support and security they deserve with new changes to the retentions payment regime under the Construction Contracts Act 2002. We know, Mr Speaker, that when construction firms dip into money that isn't theirs, and if they then collapse and go into liquidation, that it's our hard-working builders, plumbers, electricians and other tradies who are hit the hardest. These changes will ensure that we're delivering security for our subbies. It's great to be in this House, Mr Speaker, for a second day in a row to talk about concrete changes this government is making to ensure that our building and construction sector are put back to work.
Supplementary. What are the proposed changes?
Mr Speaker, the changes that I'm proposing are these. The government is making three big changes to the Construction Contracts Act 2002 to deliver security for our subbies. First, we're introducing new offence and penalties for firms and for company directors who don't comply with their responsibilities. So for companies, it'll be a fine of up to $200,000. For company directors, a fine of up to $50,000. Second, we're strengthening how retention money is held so no one can dip into it and use it as working capital. And third, we're making firms issue a transparency report about how much retention funds are being held and where those funds are being held. These changes give the existing law the teeth that it deserves.
How will this affect construction firms who are already worried about an uncertain economic outlook?
Mr Speaker, I want to reassure the vast majority of law-abiding construction firms that they will barely notice the difference. This isn't going to make life harder or more expensive for our head contractors and contractors who are already putting retention funds aside or who already pay their subbies in full. This is about going after those cowboys, those who knowingly dip into subcontractors' money for their own cash flow when they know that they shouldn't. We'll hold those firms accountable and we'll go after the company directors as well. It's always unfortunate, Mr Speaker, when construction firms go under, but our subbies shouldn't be the ones paying the price.
That concludes oral questions.